The Guardian.
This is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Char. On this week's podcast, we look at the extraordinary life of HeLa cells and the woman they came from, Henrietta Lacks.
They are the first immortal human cells ever grown in culture, which means that they will essentially grow in a laboratory forever.
Just who was Henrietta Lacks, and why is she so important to medical science?
They were used to help develop the polio vaccine. They went up in the first space missions to see what would happen to human cells in zero gravity. Her cells were the first ever cloned. Her genes were some of the first ever mapped. They were used to create some of our most important cancer medications that we use today.
Plus, every day's a school day at the European Space Agency's astronaut training facility.
Fluid physics and biology, in addition to some of the practical skills such as diving training, learning about photography, learning about computer engineering, including stripping them down and rebuilding them, obviously on board the space station.
This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome back, everyone. In the studio today, we've got author Rebecca Skloot. Her book, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, details the life of a woman who died 60 years ago, but whose cells are very much still alive today. They're called HeLa cells, and they've been used in everything from making vaccines to basic biological research for the past 50 years. But first, Rebecca, just tell us who Henrietta Lacks was.
Henrietta was a 30-year-old black woman who lived in Southern Virginia in the United States, and she grew up on the same tobacco farm that her ancestors had worked as slaves. And yeah, she didn't have much education. She would have had no idea what a cell was. And at 30, she was diagnosed with cervical cancer, and she went to the doctor, and this was at Johns Hopkins. She and her family had moved north to Baltimore in search of work for her husband. And she went to Hopkins, and yeah, the standard treatment of the day was radium therapy, where they would take tubes of radioactive material and literally sew those to the surface of the cervix and sort of leave them there for a few days. And before applying the radium, without telling her, her doctor just took a little slice of her tumor and put it in a dish and sent that down the hall to George Guy, who was the head of tissue culture research at Hopkins. And he'd been trying to grow human cells in culture for decades, and it had never worked. He could get them to survive for a few days, maybe a week. But even the ones that did survive, they would sort of not really do anything. They would sort of sit there and eventually die. And hers just took off. Within a few days of leaving the hospital, her cells were doubling their numbers every 24 hours. So they went from, you know, one dish to two to four to eight to 16, and they just grew with this incredible intensity that no one had ever seen.
And what made her cells so special? I mean, maybe they didn't know at the time, but in the years since, have they discovered what it is that makes her cells so special?
Not really. It's still a bit of a mystery. We know a few things about them. One is that she had HPV, the virus that causes cervical cancer, and her cells have multiple copies of the HPV genome
inserted
in
into the
cells. Yeah. And so there are some scientists who've said, well, maybe there's something about her having, you know, multiple copies of this viral genome that made her cells grow intensely. But she also had syphilis, which can weaken your immune system and cause cancer to grow more rapidly. But so did a lot of people in the 50s. And, you know, their cells didn't just grow like this. And, you know, today, it turns out cervical cancer cells in particular are very hard to grow. So other people who've had HPV, their cells didn't do this. So there's still a bit of a mystery. There's something about her cancer mixed with the HPV that just took off in a way that scientists don't really know. And it's funny, I talk in front of groups of scientists all the time, and occasionally this will come up and they'll look at each other and just be like, we don't know that? Why don't we know that? Like, we know everything else about HeLa. Why can't we answer that question? So hopefully they'll come up with a good answer soon.
And so the story of the cells goes in one direction. Well, what happened to before we go into that? What happened to Henrietta Lacks? How long did she survive after that biopsy?
Yeah, her cancer grew with the same kind of intensity in her body that it did in the lab. And when she first went in, her tumor was about the size of a nickel. And within just a few months, every organ in her body had been taken over by this tumor, and she died just after her 31st birthday, and left five kids behind. She never knew the cells grew. No one had told her kids that they had grown. And, you know, her cancer, there was something about the cancer that, you know, like the cells, her doctor, he's 99 years old now. He still very clearly remembers those, her cancer. He just said, I've never seen a cancer spread like hers spread, grow as fast and, you know, have the kind of intense symptoms. I mean, she was in a lot of pain. It was a really difficult death.
The cells were then cultured, as you said, by Dr. Guy. Did he ever meet Henrietta Lacks?
That is also a little bit of a mystery. Everyone that I talked to said no, he never met her. It wouldn't have been something that he would have done. But there's one woman who he worked with who said she very clearly remembers him telling her that he went to Henrietta's bedside at one point once he knew that the cells were as going to be as important as they were, and that he told her, you know, your cells will make you immortal, they'll live forever and help people, and that she said that that was a good thing and made her happy, which, you know, would be in line.
Do you believe that?
Right. I mean, who knows? There's no reason why this woman would have made that up. It's definitely in line with both of their personalities. I mean, George Guy, that is something I could see him having done. But, you know, where the story, I can see her being happy that the cells would help someone, but she wouldn't have understood what a cell was. She wouldn't have understood what immortality was. By that point, she was also so heavily medicated, she wouldn't have been, none of it would have seemed even real to her. She was on so much morphine and various other drugs. But I don't disbelieve it. I could see it happening.
I mean, the story of the Lacks family obviously continues after that. We'll come back to that a bit later, but let's talk about the cells again. So at what point did Dr. Guy realize that this was the immortal cell line that he'd spent several decades with his wife looking for?
Yeah, it took a little while. They started growing and growing. Like, his wife described them as growing like crabgrass that they just sort of took over the laboratory. And he was very kind of hesitant to be excited about it for quite a while. But after a few months of this, he realized what he had and started telling other scientists. And they all immediately just said, "Can we have some?" And he did. He just gave them to any researcher anywhere in the world who wanted to use them for research. And you know, today you go online, you order some cells, they send it to you by mail, but you know, that wasn't the case at the time. He or his wife or his assistant would go to the airport with tubes of cells.
There's quite a nice detail you had in the book about pilots putting them in their pockets to keep them warm.
Right. He would go to, right. And the idea of this happening today, you know, in the high security, you know, world is sort of impossible to imagine. But yeah, he would just go up to a pilot or a flight attendant and say, "Will you put this tube in your pocket and fly it to, you know, Minneapolis or London or wherever?" And scientists would wait on the other end, grab the cells, run back to their labs and grow them and give them to their friends who give them to their friends, and they really quickly spread all over the world that way.
I mean, the idea of a cell culture might seem quite clear, that you could then do things to the cells, and in terms of research, whether it's looking at toxins or the effects of certain environmental contaminants or whatever, you could do all sorts of research with these cells. But why are cancer cells useful in this respect? Because, I mean, the cancer cells are essentially cells that have gone wrong.
Right. It is very sort of counterintuitive to think that there's all this incredible research that on other diseases that came from cancer cells. And some of it is that there are things that are normal about HeLa cells. I mean, there's a lot that's abnormal because they're cancer. But, you know, they have cell membranes that viruses have to get through, just like any other cell. They produce proteins and they metabolize things. And so the things that they do that normal cells do, you can study in the cancer cells. And in fact, the fact that they're cancer in some cases makes them more useful for that, because they do everything faster. In the 50s in particular, one of the things that they were so useful for was viral research, and they can work like little factories. You infect them with a virus, and they grow. The cells grow and grow, and the virus grows with them. So they can mass produce virus, and then you can extract that from the cells, or enzymes, or various other things. And the range of what you can do with HeLa cells to this day is sort of amazing. Now scientists can actually alter them and turn them into, make them behave like, you know, a heart cell or a brain cell or a normal cell. So there are ways to use them and change them.
So essentially they're biological machines and they just happen to replicate very well. And you don't worry about the fact that they've got extra chromosomes.
For some things you do. I mean, there's definitely some research that it just wouldn't be appropriate to use. But yeah, they're sort of like fruit flies, you know, white lab mice. I mean, they're a workhorse that provides this baseline. It's like, you know what HeLa is, you know how it grows, it's sort of predictable. And so the way, when you expose it to something and then it changes, you know where you started from. And it's cheap and it's easy to grow a lot of it.
Which is even more surprising then that the scientists don't really know why this happens, right. Given that it might be an interesting. Well, I mean, obviously it's not that important in terms of the cures and the research that's been done on them, but it seems mm-hmm. to be a bit of a black hole. Is anyone looking at this?
Well, yeah, it's funny. There, I think some of it is that when they first grew, people were just so excited that they finally had the cells. They were like, you know, the last thing they wanted to figure out was why they grew. They're like, we just want to use them for other things. And then since then, they're just everywhere. They're just sort of, you know, you've got the test tubes, you've got the HeLa cells, and so they've been there for so long that people just don't really, I think, stop to think about where they came from or why. And but yeah, as I've gone around and talked to these scientists, and this question comes up, a few of them have said, okay, I'm going to try to get you a better answer to that question, because there's obviously a reason.
There's a hint, isn't there? There's a hint yeah. in your book about telomeres and mm-hmm. a specific enzyme that sort of is running, which means that normally when cells divide, the sort of caps at the end of the chromosomes get shorter and shorter until eventually, if they're too short, they can't divide again. Whereas with HeLa cells, that doesn't happen at all.
Right, all cancer cells. And so, right, so we know that part of why cancer cells just grow and grow and grow is because, right, their telomeres get rebuilt as they get shortened, so they just never get old and never die. So mechanically, we know that's why her cells stay alive. But why that happened in her cells outside of the body when it didn't in others, even other cancer cells, that's where the mystery is. Yeah.
Now, it's all not all of it is good news in terms of the fact that this cell is so good at reproducing. It seems to have contaminated millions and millions of dollars and pounds worth of research all over the world. Tell us a bit about that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It's so after the HeLa cells were first grown, scientists began growing a sort of library of other tissues. They would take samples from, you know, prostates and breast cancer cells, and because they wanted to have a lot of different kinds of tissues to study. And at some point in the late 60s, one scientist realized that they were basically almost all HeLa cells, and that scientists, without realizing it, had been growing and regrowing HeLa, thinking they were growing other things.
How did they get there?
Because cells can float on dust particles in the air. If you touch a dish and then don't wash your hands and you go touch another dish, you can transfer them from one to the other. If you use a pipette, you know, the device they use to suction cells out, and then you go reuse it with another kind of cell, you can transfer them. And HeLa cells grow so powerfully that they just take over. So if just one or two HeLa cells fall into a dish, they'll just grow and grow and essentially outgrow anything that's in there and take over. And you can't really tell from the outside, just looking with a naked eye. So yeah, this caused millions of dollars in damage and a lot of controversy because it called some research results into question. And this is actually what eventually led to tracking down Henrietta's kids, was an effort to sort out the problem. They wanted to use DNA from her kids to develop a test to see what was HeLa and what wasn't. But I'm sure we'll talk about that. But and to this day, contamination is still a big problem in research labs.
Well, let's go back to her family. So after the cells were taken they went off in the direction we've described, what happened to her family? When did the family themselves come back into the scientific questioning?
Not for a long time. So Henrietta died in 51, and in the early 70s, in order to settle this controversy about the contamination, one scientist decided to track down her kids to get DNA samples from them. And he figured he could sort of treat it like a crime scene. And if the cells out there matched her kids' DNA, then they were obviously from their mother. And so he sent a postdoc of his to call Henrietta's family to get samples. And, you know, Henrietta's husband had a third grade education. He didn't know what a cell was. And he got this phone call one day. And the way he understood it was, we've got your wife. She's alive in a laboratory. We've been doing research on her for the last 25 years, and now we have to test your kids to see if they have cancer, which wasn't what the scientist said at all. She said, we need to look at their HLA markers and compare those to the HeLa cells. And he thought they had Henrietta in a cell like a prison cell. That was the only kind of cell he'd ever heard of. So his family got sucked into this world of research that they didn't understand, and the scientists didn't realize that the family didn't understand. So it was this, it went on for years.
Completely different worlds. Mm-hmm. The family got involved in the research again, did they?
Well, so it went on for years. The scientists would come and take samples and leave, and it went beyond that identification of cell contamination. So that it did, you know, they did determine, yes, that the HeLa cells had taken over. But then scientists started hearing, oh, someone has access to her kids, and I'd like DNA for some other research related to HeLa cells. And so the scientists would come back, and it went on like that for quite a long time. And, you know, eventually the family sort of realized she wasn't alive. They couldn't go visit her, you know, in the way she'd been before she died. But they didn't understand what it meant to have part of her alive. And her daughter, in particular, was very worried that the research being done on the cells would actually cause her mother some sort of pain. She worried, you know, when you infect her with herself with the poliovirus, does that then cause her mother to feel the symptoms of polio wherever she is in the afterlife? And can she rest in peace if all this is going on? And the family never got really answers to those questions. The other thing that came up with that was quite difficult for them was the issue of money. So in addition to all the important science done on the cells, they were the first ever commercialized. So we now have this, you know, enormous industry based on buying and selling tissues and cells, patenting genes. And it started with her cells, but her children to this day don't have any money.
So companies have made billions from her cells, but her family still, as you say in the book, can't afford health insurance.
Yeah, exactly. And that's a hard irony for them to, yes, sort of live with. And
we talked a little bit earlier about the scientists not knowing necessarily about how the cells are so good, but how many scientists know about the origin of these cells and are aware of the fact that her family has not benefited in any way, or the fact that when they were first approached, they were so horribly miscommunicated to?
None. Yeah, scientists definitely don't know that story at all. And it's amazing for me to hear scientists' reactions. So most scientists have heard that the cells came from Helen Lane, which was a pseudonym that was put out in the 50s to essentially throw journalists off the track of finding her family. So that was this fake name created. And there are, you know, biology textbooks out there to this day that say, you know, HeLa cells from a woman named Helen Lane. Occasionally they have a picture of this white woman, and I have no idea who she is. Most scientists have, if they've heard anything, heard that it came from Helen Lane. And they often feel a little swindled by it. So they hear this story and they're like, wait a minute, like my textbook, it says right here it came from Helen Lane. And for them and for other scientists, they just often haven't ever stopped to think about where they came from. And I hear again and again from researchers who, you know, read the book and get in touch with me and say, you know, I spent my whole career working on these cells. I did my dissertation on them. You know, I work with them every day in the lab, and I never stopped to wonder where they came from or whether she gave permission. And they sort of feel bad about that. They're very glad to know the story. And it's a, you know, there are so many sort of elements of the story. It's about the importance of communicating science to people. And I think the reaction that scientists often have is that they're very appreciative to have this sort of case study to be able to look at and say, this is why it's important to be able to talk to people. This is why it's important that we remember every biological sample has a person behind it. And so I hear that a lot.
Well, it raises also questions about the ethics of taking cells without permission. When Henrietta Lacks' cells were taken, she wasn't asked. She was getting treatment from her doctor, but the doctor, as you said, took a piece the size of a coin and gave it to Dr. Guy, who then cultured the cells. But how did that make you feel writing this story about how this woman's body was essentially used by the scientific community for, in the end, good purposes? But at that point in time, I mean, no one would argue that what they did was right.
Actually, most people would argue that what they did was perfectly fine by the standards of the day. And that's where the story is hard sometimes for people to wrap their minds around. So a lot of times, you know, when I go out and talk in the general public, there's this, they stole her cells, they didn't ask. And, you know, you can't look at it knowing what we know today. So in 1951, we didn't even have the concept of informed consent like we do now. They didn't know what was inside of a cell. They didn't know what DNA was. They had no idea someday they'd be able to look in the cells, learn about her family. They had no concept that they'd be worth money. You know, it was very standard to take samples from people. It was considered garbage. And, you know, why wouldn't you try to then use that for good research? And in some cases, that's still the case. I mean, there are a lot of ways in which the thinking about research on cells hasn't changed a lot. The big thing that's changed is you wouldn't have someone's name attached to it. You would anonymize it completely. But still, samples are used without informed consent all the time in research, as long as your identity is not attached to it.
Well, exactly. If the cells hadn't been cultured, I mean, the world would be a very different place.
Yeah, and chances are there have been other immortal cell lines since, none quite like hers. Hers were still very unique. But, you know, they would have made a lot of these advances, just not with the sort of maybe speed or intensity that they did. But yeah, absolutely. If they had asked her, I mean, you know, but the thing I hear again and again, there have been a lot of lawsuits about people where people have found out that their tissues were used in research without consent, and they've, you know, sued for one reason or another. And I've talked to a lot of people who were involved in those cases, and they've all said, you know, if they had just asked us, we would have said yes. You know, people get why this is important and they want to help. So I think that people are open to it. And a lot of what happens is you get these cases that hit the press when it's discovered that something happened. Like, I mean, here you had the Alder Hey case, which was, you know, people, you know, researchers taking samples from dead children without consent and using them in research. And the backlash that happened because of the news of that getting out was that people stopped wanting to donate anything for research. They stopped wanting to donate organs for transplantation. So, you know, when people find out it happens, that actually has a bad effect on science.
Ownership and the consent mm-hmm. part is much, much worse than what you might do to the cells in the
foot.
Oh, by far.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, it's very much about disclosure, I think.
I think it was in the early 90s, you mentioned in the book, that someone suggested that because the cells have been growing for so long and evolved into all sorts of different things, that they might be classed as a completely different species, which is an interesting concept. I'm not sure that this has been defined scientifically, but someone suggested they might be called Helicyton gartleri, so they're not related to humans at all, or evolved from humans in sense.
Right, that they're their own species entirely. And it was interesting, there were actually two separate research papers that happened almost at the same time that argued that, completely unrelated to each other. And it's, you know, no one's ever challenged the theory, and it makes a lot of sense. You know, they started from a single cell and they grew into what is now, I mean, there are so many different lines of HeLa, because HeLa growing, you know, in your lab in the UK would do something potentially very different than they do in my lab over in the US, where they're exposed to different things. And so you get mutations and changes, and they evolve into these different lines. So what you have now are so many different strains of HeLa that
it fits all the definitions of evolution.
Right. They're all sort of cousins to the initial strains. And so it really, they do behave like a single-celled organism. And so, yeah, the argument, it holds up, and no one ever challenged it, but no one ever did anything about it either. So they just sort of put it out there, and then that was it.
Okay, Rebecca's book, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, is out now. You can join our Facebook group, by the way. We've called ourselves the Guardian Science Weekly podcast, where you can chat with other listeners and post comments on the wall. We'll also let you know every Monday when a new podcast is uploaded.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
What's it like preparing to be an astronaut? Major Tim Peake is 8 months into his 18-month basic training program in Cologne. The former Army Air Corps officer is the first British citizen to be selected as an astronaut by the European Space Agency. He beat thousands of other wannabe spacemen and spacewomen to the position. He took his helmet off long enough for Ian Sample to thrust a microphone into his face.
A lot of it has been classroom-based, obviously, to start us off with academic training. But as well as that, there's been a real mix of some great practical skills thrown in there as well. On the academic side, we've spent 3 months learning Russian, doing an intensive Russian language course. We've also learned about subjects such as fluid physics and biology, in addition to some of the practical skills, such as diving training as part of the neutral buoyancy facility, learning about photography, learning about computer engineering, including stripping them down and rebuilding them. Obviously, on board the space station, we have to be responsible for taking care of all of our equipment. And to that end, crew healthcare as well. We've done a lot of practical first aid training, which has been very interesting.
You used to fly Apache helicopters, which are pretty serious bit of equipment, and now you're I don't know if you've started yet, or you'll be going on to learning how to do, you know, in simulators, how to fly presumably a Soyuz.
That's right, yes. We've just started learning about Soyuz rendezvous and docking. We've had a go in the simulator already, which for me as a pilot was the best part of the training so far. Really enjoyed getting back into the cockpit, which is great. And also we've been learning about, for example, the Columbus laboratory and the various experiments that we're going to have to perform on board the space station.
Take us through the simulator, though. I mean, as I say, you're used to being in an Apache cockpit, and I don't know how big they are. I presume they're probably fairly small. I actually don't know if it's just one of you or if you have like someone with you in that. But when you're in the Soyuz, what's it? You know, do these things at all compare?
Not really. The Apache is a tandem cockpit with normally the pilot flying from the rear seat. And actually, they're quite roomy cockpits. Normally, the gunner is in the front-hand seat. In the Soyuz, there's three people all sitting side by side with the commander flying the spacecraft from the center seat and the flight engineer monitoring from the left-hand seat. Yes, the flight controls are completely different, using two sidearm controllers. One on the left to control thrust in both forwards, reverse, and translating left, right, up and down.
Reverse?
Absolutely. And in the right hand, you control your attitude, pitch, and roll attitude. So you've got a six-axis vehicle and two separate hand controllers.
What lies ahead in the training to come?
We've got a parabolic flight campaign. I think for all of us, that's one of the highlights of the astronaut training.
And this is what people might know as like the vomit comet type thing.
That's right, yes. Each flight's about 2.5 hours and includes 32, 33 parabolas, each one lasting up to about 20 seconds of weightlessness. We've got various tasks that we have to perform during each parabola, basically to introduce us to weightlessness and then to try to get us to do some various tasks that we might be expected to perform on board the space station.
So these are physical tasks rather than mental tasks. I mean, they're not, well, what sort of things?
They are physical tasks. For example, on a couple of them, we'll practice manoeuvring as if we were doing an extravehicular activity, using the grapples and the hooks for externally to the space station. On one of the other tasks, we'll practice running on the treadmill in zero G, using the straps to hold us down. And then we also get a little bit of time to have some fun ourselves flying around the cockpit and practicing rotating, spinning, and just controlling our bodies in weightlessness.
What is this? The European Astronaut Corps now must be, I don't know, something like a dozen people or something like that?
It's 14 strong, right. including the six new astronauts. And we currently have two astronauts flying this year, Roberto Vittori on one of the final shuttle sorties, and Paolo Nespoli, who's going to do a six-month tour to the space station. We have André Kuipers, who is going to be flying after Paolo in 2012, again a six-month tour to the space station. Mm. And then in 2013 is the first opportunity where there's yet nobody assigned to that flight.
We're all sort of aware that the shuttle is coming to an end, that the that fleet will be basically grounded to make way for whatever NASA comes up with next, which will obviously presumably put everybody in a queue for Soyuz. I mean, how is that situation being sort of taken by the astronaut corps, and does that really change anything materially?
That has been planned for a long time in advance. The space station is now at its full complement of six, and the Soyuz is able to maintain the International Space Station at a crew level of six up until its life extension, which now goes out to 2020. But in addition, I think that we'll definitely see private companies doing cargo transfer to the space station, and maybe by the end of the decade we'll also see private companies doing manned launch and return to and from the space station.
Astronaut Tim Peake there, talking to Guardian science correspondent Ian Sample. If you follow this podcast on Twitter, our handle is @ScienceWeekly. We're going to let you know every time a new podcast is uploaded. For all the rest of the Guardian Science content, you can follow Guardian Science.
Science Weekly from Guardian.co.uk.
Thanks to Rebecca Skloot for coming in. Her book, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, is out now. Don't forget to add your voice to our debate at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. Last week's blog, by the way, for the Climate Get Emails podcast is possibly our most commented on yet. Make sure you have a listen and add your thoughts. That's at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.